lots of friends, but can I interrupt all the lots of friends? And we'll get started on the great lecture. And I don't think I need to introduce myself to almost anybody in the room, but I'm Christine Chinkin from the Centre of Women, Peace and Security. Welcome to you all. I'm delighted to see you all here to have this discussion about where would we be today without CEDAW. And I'm especially delighted to welcome back to the LSE Justice Aruna Devi Narain, who I'll introduce properly in just a moment. But I think just in sort of 2 minutes, that the Centre of Women, Peace and Security is committed to research, public engagement, events, etc., in various ways that advance women's rights, peace and security. And I think that CEDAW, another friend, CEDAW is absolutely core to all of these, to women's rights, to the cause of peace, and the overall idea of women's security. And the way in which the convention has been interpreted, developed, applied by the CEDAW committee, of course, is being instrumental in keeping it to the forefront, keeping it alive over 40 years since its existence. And absolutely delighted to welcome, as well as Aruna, other members of the CEDAW committee who are here today as well. So sort of really delighted to welcome you to what we're calling a celebration of 40 years of CEDAW. It just drives me mad. Everybody's talking about every other anniversary at the moment. Nobody mentions 40 years of CEDAW. And you know, CEDAW is still the instrument of legal obligation with respect to the advancement of women's human rights. And that, to my mind, is absolutely core. But we've only got an hour, so I'll keep this very brief and turn to introduce our speaker. Aruna Devi Narain was a LLB and LLM graduate at the LSE, hence the words back to the LSE. She keeps saying she can't recognise anything because it has changed so much since then. But this is still the LSE, and we very much welcome having you back here again. Aruna was called to the Middle Temple, London, and to the bar at Mauritius. She was a law officer at the Attorney General's office in Mauritius from 1993 to 2015. She's appeared as counsel for the state in many cases before the Committee of the Privy Council and, of course, in the courts of Mauritius. I will go off script here and say just very briefly that she was also involved in the early stages of the Chagos Islands and particularly the arbitration relating to the Chagos Islands. And not surprisingly, is quite pleased with the way that the ICJ and now the General Assembly are directing the issues with respect to the Chagos Islands. She's got numerous firsts, two just to mention. She was the first Lady Parliamentary Counsel of Mauritius in 2011, the first Deputy Electoral Commissioner for General Elections in 2014, a member of the Law Reform Commission, I could go on with many, but has also, of course, been a member of the Supreme Court of Mauritius since, and I must have it down here, puny judge of the Supreme Court of Mauritius since July 2015. And what's most relevant, of course, in today's context, although all those other qualifications are why you are where you are, is that she's been a member of the CEDAW committee since 2017 and was elected at the beginning of your four-year term at the beginning of this year. So Aruna is clearly very well qualified to answer the question about where would we be without CEDAW. So Aruna, welcome, and hand over to you. Aruna will talk for about 35, 40 minutes. There'll be a little time for some questions. One other housekeeping event. We have somebody, Bhavna, where are you? Taking photographs here, right at the front of the event. If anybody is concerned about being on such a photograph, please get in touch with Zoe Gillard at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. And of course, we would not use anybody's photo if anybody is concerned about being in such a photo. Yeah? Okay, over to you, Aruna.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Christine, and thank you very much for organising this. It's, obviously, it means a lot to me. I'm very pleased to see my friend Rebecca, who was at university with me 30 years ago.
Wow.
And LSE, Rebecca, is the place where the concrete never sets. It's very hard for us to find our way around, but we should keep coming. So now I'll go back to my script. This is for the
PowerPoint. Can you?
I'm very sure.
Again, which one is it? Do
this one?
Don't ask me about the PowerPoint.
Thank you very much. Okay. So gives me great pleasure, and this is great, real honor for me to be addressing you this afternoon in the Wolfson Theatre at the London School of Economics. And I would like, as I just said, to thank you, Christine, Kina, Mobuba, and the Center for Women, Peace and Security at LSE for making this happen. Is it working? Too sure? This one? I'm sorry, I'll probably have to get you to
this one.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just this one.
Yeah, okay. So 30 years ago, I would have been sitting for my second year LLB examinations here at LSE, as maybe current LLB students are doing this very week. This beautiful theatre had not yet come into being, nor had Emerita Professor Christine Chinkin joined the LSE yet. But we had our fair share of prestigious academics at the time, from whom I learned immensely. Off the top of my head, and in no particular order, I would mention Professor Rosalind Higgins, Professor Michael Zander, Professor Carol Harlow, Professor Leonard Lee, and my own personal tutor, Miss Mary Percival, who became almost a friend. Those were also the days when an LSE law student could elect to take options in other colleges of the University of London, and I'm not sure whether this is still possible. But while doing my LLB and LLM at LSE, I followed courses at King's College, at UCL, and at SOAS, which I found most enriching. I thus had the opportunity of being taught by Professor Philip Sens, QC, then at the Center for International Environmental Law at King's, and also now a personal friend, and more importantly, a friend of Mauritius. Coming to the theme of today, I should add that my engagement with women's rights probably started during my third year at LSE, 1989 to 1990, when I decided to take what was then a pioneering optional subject called Women and the Law. It was taught by Professor Erika Shishak, who had then just co-authored a book on equality and sex discrimination law. I remember then reading articles written by Catherine MacKinnon, the renowned American feminist legal scholar, whom I had the honor of meeting last year at a UN Women Think Space in New York. Back in 1989, I was only familiar with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, that on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the ICSCR, and probably the Convention Against Torture, or CAT. And it is here, at LSE, that I first heard about the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, better known under the acronym CEDAW. Thank you, LSE, for opening my eyes to CEDAW and much more. So, what is CEDAW? What has it brought us? And indeed, where would we be today without CEDAW? I should specify at the outset that although the acronym CEDAW is used in literature to refer to either the convention or the committee, I shall be using it today to refer only to the convention and shall refer to the committee as the CEDAW committee. Now CEDAW, the convention, has often been described as an international bill of rights for women. As we are this year celebrating its 40th anniversary, you will have worked out that the convention was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1979, a few years after the International Women's Year in 1975, and in the middle of the UN decade for women, which spanned from 1975 to 1985. It remains the only international treaty exclusively focusing on women's rights, although there are now regional counterparts. In my own region, in Africa, a protocol to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights on the Rights of Women in Africa, better known as the Maputo Protocol, was signed in 2003. As at the first May 2019, 189 states, that is over 95% of the UN membership, have ratified or acceded to CEDAW, and thus voluntarily agreed to protect, promote, respect, and implement the human rights of women, and to be reviewed by the CEDAW committee in that regard. Further, 112 states have accepted the competence of the committee to receive and consider individual cases against them under the optional protocol to CEDAW, which we usually refer to as OPCEDAW. It continues to be a matter for regret, however, that the United States and six other states have still not ratified CEDAW, while many states have entered and maintain reservations to key articles of the convention, especially Article 16 on marriage and family relations, which is a core provision of CEDAW. Likewise, the relatively low number of states parties to OPCEDAW and the lack of visibility of the optional protocol, especially in the African and Asian regions, need to be addressed. The CEDAW committee, for its part, is the treaty body established under CEDAW to monitor the progress made by states parties in implementing the convention. It consists of 23 experts elected by secret ballot from all geographical regions and diverse professional backgrounds, comprising, among others, academics, diplomats, historians, activists, judges like myself, and lawyers, or as some of us prefer to say, people with a legal background. Not surprisingly, it is the only treaty body where women members outnumber men, and by far. In fact, right now, there are 2 men on the committee out of 23 members, while last year there was only 1 man. CEDAW committee members, like members of other treaty bodies, are guided in the discharge of their functions by the Addis Ababa guidelines on the independence and impartiality of human rights treaty body members. Objectively speaking, and I declare my interest as a CEDAW committee member, the committee is recognized as being a bold, dynamic, progressive, and hard-working treaty body, and its work has often been applauded at the international level. Only this year, it received the 2019 award from the Group of Francophone Ambassadors under the auspices of the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie in recognition of its work in 2018. Some even claim that it should be considered for the Nobel Peace Prize. Time will tell. Former CEDAW committee members have gone on to achieve even greater things within and outside the UN system in promoting, realizing, and implementing women's rights. As a Mauritian, I am proud to mention my predecessor on the committee, Pramila Patten, who was vice chair of the committee and is now the special representative of the UN Secretary General on sexual violence in conflict. I will also refer to Ms. Dubravka Simonovic from Croatia, former chair of the committee as well, now UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women. Late last year, I was honored to receive in Mauritius Justice Desiree Patricia Bernard, who chaired the committee from 1985 to 1989 and went on to become Chief Justice of Guyana and the First Lady Justice of the Caribbean Court of Justice. Professor Feride Achar, former chair of the CEDAW committee and outgoing president of Grevio, was last week in Strasbourg awarded the Pro Merito Medal, one of the highest Council of Europe honors. Finally, 4 members of the committee were listed, alongside Professor Chinkin, on Apolitical's 100 Most Influential People in Gender Policy Around the World, including Professor Dalia Linarte, present today and also former chair of the committee. So what exactly has the committee achieved in those 40 years? I should open a parenthesis to stress that, of course, not all achievements under CEDAW are those of the CEDAW committee. Probably the most significant ones are those generated by activists successfully invoking CEDAW on the ground to prevent discrimination, or proactive judges in domestic courts making findings of discrimination using local law together with a broad definition in Article 1 of CEDAW and making appropriate awards of compensation, or sensitized parliamentarians striving to extend the statutory protection afforded to women and girls by relying on thematic articles of CEDAW and so on. However, in the interest of time, I shall today be concentrating on the work of the CEDAW committee and shall focus on the following five sub-aspects. First, discrimination and reinforcement of women's rights. Second, state party reporting and concluding observations. Third, general recommendations. Fourth, communications under the optional protocol. And fifth, inquiries under the optional protocol. I shall look at each of these in turn, bearing in mind that within the short time that we have, we can only have a very quick overview of each area. First, discrimination and reinforcement of women's rights. It is often said that the definition of discrimination in CEDAW is a particularly strong one, and it is worth my reading it out. I quote, "For the purposes of the present convention, the term discrimination against women shall mean any distinction, exclusion, or restriction made on the basis of sex, which has the effect or purpose of impairing or nullifying the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise by women, irrespective of the marital status, on a basis of equality of men and women, of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the political, economic, social, cultural, civil, or any other field," unquote. This is the basis, the core of CEDAW. All acts that fall within this definition of discrimination should be identified, addressed, and eliminated. Unlike the two UN covenants mentioned earlier, CEDAW does not limit itself to rights and freedoms in the civil, political, economic, social, and cultural fields, but can apply to any other field. This has allowed the committee, when considering communications under the optional protocol, to address rights not referred to expressly in the convention, such as the right to life, or the right to protection from torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. The committee has also repeatedly, in its general recommendations, concluding observations and views, indicated that the convention applies also to intersectional discrimination. Natalie Kaufman-Hevener has, in a book entitled International Law and the Status of Women, 1983, broken down instruments dealing with women's rights into three categories: protective, corrective, and non-discriminatory. And she found that CEDAW contains all three types of provisions. It is also acknowledged by commentators that the committee has been particularly progressive with regard to the state parties' obligations of due diligence towards non-state actors, especially in violence cases, but also with regard to reproductive health and gender stereotyping. I shall later talk about the committee's general recommendations. Suffice it for me to mention that in one of those general recommendations, GR number 25, the committee elaborated on the concepts of equality and discrimination for the guidance of stakeholders. Next, I turn to state party reporting and concluding observations. This is the aspect of the work of the committee with which most people would be familiar. State parties have to submit a periodic report to the committee every 4 years on their implementation of the convention within that period, and the committee members put questions to the state party delegation at a public meeting based on the state party's own report and its replies to the committee's list of issues, reports from NGOs, civil society, national human rights institutions, and other sources. This is usually referred to as a constructive dialogue between the state party and the committee. It generally takes part in Geneva, but video conferences are increasingly being resorted to. Concluding observations, or COBs, or COBs, are then issued by the committee, in which they highlight positive and negative aspects and make recommendations. These are expected to be widely disseminated for effective follow-up at national level. In addition, the committee has its own follow-up rapporteurs who carefully assess the extent to which the committee's recommendations have been implemented. I should add that since 2015, the committee allows states to avail themselves of the Simplified Reporting Procedure, or SRP, and to respond to specific issues identified by the committee in a list of issues instead of preparing each time a voluminous report of measures taken or not taken under each and every article of the convention. The response of the state party to the list of issues is then treated as the state party's report for the relevant period. This procedure was suspended temporarily by the committee in 2017 and reintroduced in 2018, albeit on specified conditions. The SRP is particularly attractive to smaller states' parties which face resource challenges and what is sometimes referred to as reporting fatigue, and they tend then to lag behind with their reporting obligations. The committee has also issued reporting guidelines for the benefit of states' parties, and I would also mention that the issue of sustainable development, including SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, has been promptly taken on board by the committee, which is in fact the first UN treaty body to integrate SDG targets and indicators in its state party reporting guidelines. I shall later refer to the COBs issued by the committee to the UK earlier this year with regard to abortion laws in Northern Ireland. Suffice it for me to highlight a few other significant recommendations of the committee in those COBs after the UK presented its report earlier this year. So among those recommendations were that the UK should review and withdraw its reservations to CEDAW, that the UK should ensure the inclusion of CEDAW provisions and of the European Convention on Human Rights in its domestic legislation. It should ensure that there is no retrogression in the protection of women's rights and should adopt measures to ensure that its domestic legislation keeps pace with progress on women's rights in the European Union. Another recommendation is that the UK should undertake a comprehensive assessment of the impact of austerity measures and of the proposed withdrawal of the UK from the European Union on the rights of women and adopt mitigating measures without delay. At the same session in March this year, the committee considered what is referred to as an exceptional report from Myanmar. That state party had been reviewed and COBs had been issued by the committee in 2016. The committee, however, chose not to await the next periodic report of Myanmar, but took the rare step in 2017 of seeking a report on an exceptional basis on the situation of Rohingya women and girls in northern Rakhine State in Myanmar, which had to be submitted within 6 months. The committee operated through a task force led by the rapporteur, my friend Nala Haider, who's right there at the back. And issues pertaining inter alia to the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, impunity for sexual violence offences allegedly perpetrated by the military, citizenship and statelessness were raised by the committee during the dialogue with the delegation of the state party. And they were called upon to provide replies to often searching questions. Next, general recommendations. Most treaty bodies issue general comments, but the CEDAW committee under Article 21 of CEDAW issues general recommendations, or GRs. I'm not sure why they're termed differently, but what I do know is that our 37 GRs, especially recent ones since the GR number 19 in 1992, are a real source of guidance to states' parties and all stakeholders on working methods, as well as substantive articles of the convention relating to education, equality within the family, health, participation in political and public life, and issues such as female circumcision and harmful practices, and different categories of disadvantaged women, such as women with AIDS, disabled women, rural women, older women, and migrant women. Some of those GRs have rightly been described in a commentary on the convention edited inter alia by Professor Chinkin as, I quote, significant, substantive, and dynamic interpretive, unquote, recommendations, as they have sought to address issues not specifically addressed in the convention, such as gender-based violence, instead of adopting an over-narrow approach to interpreting the convention. Indeed, this proactive dynamism of the committee has led in recent years to topical general recommendations addressing contemporary phenomena impacting on women's rights. The reason why there are three other members of the CEDAW committee present at the LSE today is that we are tomorrow taking part in a workshop to brainstorm on our current draft general recommendation, which is on trafficking in women and girls in the context of global migration, which is being piloted by Professor Lenarte. This general recommendation is aimed at providing guidance to states parties on measures to be adopted to address the gendered dimensions of trafficking, including risk factors that expose migrant women and girls to sexual exploitation and abuse. This is, of course, a very topical subject and has generated considerable interest, as we witnessed at our half day of public consultations and general discussions on the 22nd of February in Geneva, which were attended by, I believe, a record number of representatives of civil society, NGOs, UN entities, states parties, and other stakeholders. This participatory procedure, of course, adds to the weight and authoritative nature of general recommendations elaborated by the committee. I should also mention general recommendation number 37 on gender-related dimensions of disaster risk reduction in the context of climate change, also on a subject of burning importance. This GR is a pioneering one, as it is believed to be the first interpretative guidance on disaster risk reduction and climate change by United Nations Human Rights Treaty Body. I would be failing in my duty if I did not also briefly mention GR number 19 on violence against women, which recognized violence against women as discrimination under Article 1 of the Convention and was revised in 2017 into GR number 35 on gender-based violence. This is a strong new general recommendation which takes into account the evolving situation regarding gender-based violence and which will be the subject of further discussions later this afternoon. I'm pleased to acknowledge the contribution of Professor Christine Chinkin to this GR, which was driven by Professor Feride Achar, whom I mentioned earlier, former chair of the committee and outgoing president of Grevio. In addition, and rather interestingly, the committee adopted in 2014, together with the Committee on the Rights of the Child, a joint general recommendation on harmful practices. This shows the interaction between human rights treaty bodies. Now, while general recommendations are not binding, they are authoritative and have occasionally been invoked before national courts. The committee also refers to them in its views on communications and COBS so that states parties and all stakeholders would be well advised to familiarize themselves with them. I need only highlight that the texts of all GRs are available on the CEDAW website. I commend them all to you, and especially GR numbers 21 on equality in marriage and family relations, 29 on the economic consequences of marriage, family relations, and the dissolution, and 33 on women's access to justice, if only because they relate to my own areas of interest as member of the committee and as judge. Fourth, communications. I'm very proud to next speak of the work of the committee with regard to communications under the optional protocol to CEDAW. I have the honor of representing the African region on the Working Group on Communications, together with my colleagues Dalia Lenarte and Nala Haider, who also represent their respective region on the Working Group. For those of you who may not be familiar with communications made to treaty bodies, these are complaints of breaches of rights enshrined in the Human Rights Treaty by individuals from those states' parties to the optional protocol to the instrument. In the case of CEDAW, a working group on individual cases under the optional protocol was established by the committee in 2001. Since then, some 142 cases have been registered against a total of around 38 states' parties to the optional protocol to CEDAW. Issues raised in communications so far concern a variety of subjects, such as, for example, divorce and maintenance issues, domestic violence and gender-based violence, maternity leave entitlements, including those of self-employed women, forced sterilization, inheritance of nobility titles, risks for complainants in cases of non-refoulement, sex trafficking, name change in case of marriage, discrimination regarding property rights, inadequate care to pregnant victims of sexual violence, child custody matters, discriminatory customary laws on inheritance, and alleged discrimination regarding pension benefits. A very wide spectrum indeed. I would hasten to add that as in domestic courts, the communication has to satisfy admissibility criteria before it can be considered on the merits. Communications are first discussed at the level of the Working Group on Communications, which at present sits for 10 days in a year, before they are dealt with at the level of the committee as a whole. The work of the committee in that regard has often been described as quasi-judicial, as it has to make a finding as to whether there's a violation of any of the rights protected under the convention, and if so, recommend a remedy. The views of the committee may well not be binding, but they constitute soft law of great persuasive value. Examples of good practices following views issued by the Committee on Communications include the granting of compensation in a forced sterilization case, in domestic violence cases, and with respect to inadequate medical care and refusal to carry out an abortion of a pregnant victim of sexual violence. In addition, Georgia has amended its legislation so that treaty bodies' views can now serve as basis for reopening domestic court decisions and constitute a basis for their review, a very significant step forward indeed. The committee felt considerably heartened last year when in August 2018, the Supreme Court of Spain acted on its views delivered in the case of González Careño and Spain, communication number 47/2012, views of 16 July 2014, and awarded compensation in the sum of €600,000 to Mrs. Angela González Careño, the author of the communication, in a particularly sad case of gender-based violence by her partner, culminating in her daughter's death. This sum is to date the highest compensation paid following the adoption of a treaty body's views. I should also mention that a follow-up dialogue is undertaken by the committee following the adoption of views on communications to ensure their implementation. Now, states parties have taken satisfactory or partly satisfactory measures in 14 out of 29 cases adopted with a finding of a violation. The implementation rate is thus situated at around 49%, which is apparently quite high compared to other treaty bodies, including the Human Rights Committee. This is one of the concrete successes in which the committee takes pride, the more so as members of the Working Group on Communications sometimes have to doggedly insist at meetings with state parties' representatives or in correspondence on implementation of those views over a fairly long and frustrating period of time. I next turn to inquiries. The optional protocol to CEDAW also provides for the committee to inquire into grave or systematic violations by a state party of rights set out in CEDAW. Inquiries are conducted at the level of a working group on inquiries, first, involving a visit by the state party with the state party's consent before the working group report is considered by the whole committee. I am, of course, not at liberty to discuss inquiries pending at the level of the committee, as they're treated confidentially. Over the years, however, the committee has conducted inquiries into a wide range of matters, including the practice of bride kidnapping in Kyrgyzstan, abduction and murders of women in Mexico, missing and murdered indigenous women in Canada, and sexual and reproductive health services in the Philippines, the reports of which are available on the committee's website. Many of you will no doubt have heard about the report published last year following an inquiry conducted by the committee into allegations by civil society organizations that the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland has committed grave and systematic violations of women's rights under CEDAW through laws restricting access of women to have abortions, women being effectively compelled to travel outside Northern Ireland to procure a legal abortion or to carry unwanted pregnancies or to carry unwanted pregnancies to term. Following a confidential inquiry involving a visit to Northern Ireland and after the views of the UK government were duly sought, the committee found that grave and systematic violations of women's rights were involved and that there were violations of Article 2 of the Convention, read with Articles 1, 5, 12, and 16, as the deliberate criminalization of abortion subjected women and girls to gender-based violence and severe physical and mental anguish that may amount to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. There were also violations of women's right to health and failure to combat stereotypes about women's roles as mothers. These findings were rejected by the UK government, but as some of you will be aware, they were referred to in a judgment delivered by the Supreme Court of the UK on the 7th of June 2018. Since not much had been done to remedy the situation when the UK presented its periodic report under CEDAW earlier this year, the committee deeply regretted in its concluding observations the continued failure of the UK to implement its previous recommendation to ensure women's access to abortion services and called upon the UK to implement those recommendations without further delay. I should add that the committee was hardly impressed by the UK's contention that this was a devolved matter for the Northern Ireland Assembly to legislate on. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, this concludes my overview of the main activities and achievements of the CEDAW Committee over the past 40 years. There is no doubt that the committee has significantly contributed to the promotion and protection of women's rights across the world during these past four decades, not least by providing guidance to states, parties, and stakeholders, by recommending remedies for individuals whose rights under the Convention have been violated, but also by causing fundamental changes to be brought to discriminatory laws and practices. The committee has proved itself to be responsive to modern evolving realities and sought to promptly address contemporary developments that may negatively impact on women's rights. It has further been progressive and purposive in its interpretation of the Convention. That the committee has a favorable track record is acknowledged by its key partners, that is civil society and the NGO community, who realize that the committee has a vital role to play in holding state parties to account for violations of women's human rights through its various powers and mechanisms. This is not to say that the committee does not face challenges. In 2007, one of my most distinguished predecessors, Hannah Beate Schopp-Schilling, member of the committee from 1989 to 2008, surveyed the work of the committee over its first 25 years. She pointed to the, what she called, worldwide persistence of discrimination against women, the then slow progress made by women in achieving their rights, and more importantly, the emergence of new challenges. Unfortunately, new challenges are still cropping up. The committee has, since its inception, had to grapple with traditional and tenacious obstacles and hindrances flowing from cultural and religious conservatism, deeply rooted gender stereotypes, and chauvinism or ignorance. In addition, it has had in recent times to be wary of plans for treaty body reform, which do not adequately take into account what Ms. Schopp-Schilling rightly described as the specificity of the committee's work. The committee has also often had to cope with budget cuts. Indeed, I would venture to say that probably the only reason why we cannot boast of 40 general recommendations on the 40th anniversary of CEDAW is because of resource constraints that have severely curtailed our ability to work on and produce general recommendations at the pace we would have wished. The matter, however, has become particularly worrying in the past few weeks, as we have just been informed that the financial situation is such that this year's autumn session is being cancelled, not only for the CEDAW committee, but for several other treaty bodies, including the Human Rights Committee. This would have dire implications for all those treaty bodies that would not only increase the reporting backlog, but seriously undermine the discharge of their duties under the optional protocol with regard to communications and inquiries. All treaty bodies concerned have, through their chairpersons, expressed their utter dismay at such a radical measure. Gratifyingly, NGOs have been quick to deplore the pernicious effect of this measure on international accountability and the fact that some states not honoring their obligations to make financial contributions to the UN in the first place might also be able to get away with violations of international human rights standards. It is to be hoped that all states' parties, which genuinely believe that such standards should be upheld and that states' parties breaching them should be held to account, will take appropriate measures in order not to allow such a dangerous precedent to take place. I'm sure that my three colleagues present here would join me in making the strongest plea for adequate resources to be made available to allow the committee, like other treaty bodies, to be more, not less, productive, diligent, and stringent with regard to the discharge of all its functions, including the consideration of state party reports, the elaboration of general recommendations, and the consideration of communications and the conduct of inquiries under the optional protocol. After all, as this stocktaking after 40 years has, I hope, confirmed, we cannot afford to be without CEDAW. May I therefore thank Professor Chinkin and the LSE again for their support and interest. Thank my son, Navneet from King's College, for helping me with the PowerPoint presentation. And thank you all for all your presence. Thank you all for your presence and your patience. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Aruna. And I think that what that did, looking at it as from a sort of 40-year perspective, really brought out how many different aspects of women's lives CEDAW actually covers. I think often we think it only just covers perhaps fairly narrow, workplace discrimination or the gender pay gap, violence, but not this breadth of issues that are so important in women's lives and in seeking substantive equality, even transformative equality, as was outlined in the commentary. We haven't got very long, for perhaps about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, but Aruna's indicated she's happy to take some questions. So if people could keep them very short to allow other people, and I'll take sort of three, and then we'll see if we've got any time for more. So, there's a mic coming.
Okay.
Well, yeah. But can you keep it very short? I see you've got a script
there. I'll try and keep it short.
My name is Dr. Davina Lloyd, and I'm the representative at the UN CEDAW Committee for Back to 60, who are taking the government to court next week because it's in breach of UN law, in breach of CEDAW, and has discriminated against 1950s women. The response we had, we've been the only group who've been trying to get CEDAW put into UK legislation. The government has responded to our petition on the UK website with the view that women and girls' rights are largely reflected in existing domestic regulation, and as such, we do not agree that we need to incorporate CEDAW. Moreover, it would create a hierarchy of rights in terms of sex as compared to other protected characteristics where the equivalent of CEDAW does not exist. I would like to know which groups with protected characteristics do not include women. The only one I can think of is men. And how do you deal with governments in complete denial?
Thank you. There was a hand over here, I think. Again, it'd be good if you could just say who you are.
My name is Rebecca Russ Savage. I'm a student of political science. I appreciated how candid you were about the challenges currently facing CEDAW and given some empirical analysis demonstrating gaps between ratification and effectiveness. I'm curious about how you think the conversation can change to make it more so, and if increased enforcement on the international level should play a role in that, and whether or not state sovereignty has a role in protecting, an exclusive role in protecting human rights.
Thank you. So essentially enforcement, implementation, and the role of state sovereignty generally. Is there a third at this point? Why don't we answer those and then see if anybody comes back.
Thank you very much for your questions. And I'd like to say that my colleagues want to reply as well, most welcome to do so, especially. I should have mentioned Ambassador Naila Gabra, who's the doyenne, I think, of committee members, and who probably has some very interesting things to say as well. Well, with regard to what you said, I was about to say probably the only group that does not include women as a disadvantaged group would be men. And we have said time and again, as I mentioned earlier on, that we believe that they're intersecting forms of discrimination. And so the fact that there is discrimination on grounds of sex doesn't mean that there cannot also be discrimination on other grounds, or disability, etc. So that doesn't mean that we should only focus on those grounds other than sex. I mean, there's a lot of literature, and I think you are more quipping than maybe asking me a genuine question on that. Yes, we do have to cope with governments in complete denial. We have to do that almost on a routine basis. But let's not be totally pessimistic. We see that there is a certain change in mindset slowly. There's a lot of work to be done still, and sometimes we have to actually go and do work in country, work with authorities, work with the NGOs, and do a lot of sensitization, but we're slowly getting there. With regard to what you said about state sovereignty, obviously this is a big issue concerning human rights, and this is what is usually invoked by what I would say defaulting states when they don't want to comply with international human rights standards. This is our right, this is our sovereignty. We have the right to enact arbitrary laws if we want to. We know what's best for our people. But of course, the standard answer to that is that the very act of signing an international agreement, is itself indicative of your sovereignty. It's only because you're a sovereign state that you have that you belong to the UN, that you have a right to sign agreements. And once you decide to sign those agreements, then you have to accept to be bound by them. And as I said earlier on, you voluntarily decide to subscribe to this agreement, you voluntarily decide to take on board those obligations, and you voluntarily decide to submit yourself to the supervision of the committee. This is a very maybe simplistic answer, but this is our very standard answer to whenever state sovereignty is raised by defaulting states.
Can I just add on to the issue about denying states and denial? The UK, I suspect, would present itself as being women-friendly. It's got the PSV, Preventing Sexual Violence and Armed Conflict Initiative. It presents itself as part of its foreign policy as being a champion of women's rights. doesn't that make it harder then when you see this complete opposite view at the domestic level? I mean, this I think is something that a lot of us grapple with respect to the UK's commitment to human rights. I know we're going to be coming onto this more later in the panel, but isn't this a matter of, does it have a different view with, depending where states are coming from?
Yeah, I think you're quite right, Christine, and this is where we need to rely a lot on our partners, on those who are working on the ground and who are there to go against the official discourse of the government and say that, wait a minute, there are violations. There might be a lot of positive achievements. Let's be candid about that. There are lots of positive achievements, more so maybe than in other countries. But at the same time, there are violations as well. And the UK, I think, is a very good example. The reason why I mentioned, I think, once or twice the UK is because not because they're particularly big defaulter, but because I thought that would be closer to home, and also because we had the concluding observations this year and the inquiry report, so that was very topical. And also, I know that several of you came to Geneva. And I think my colleagues on the committee would agree with me that we count heavily on your input to be able to alert not only us but the international community on those violations that actually exist.
Any other questions or comments? Again, to keep it, yeah.
Don't worry. I'll try to be quick. Louise Kennedy from the Northern Ireland Women's European Platform. First of all, I would like to thank all the committee members present here today for being such unflinching champions of the rights of women in Northern Ireland. We are very, very appreciative of that, the OKE inquiry and the concluding observations, which if no one's read them, fabulous for Northern Ireland. One of the interesting things that I found in the UK's last concluding observations were just the breadth, just like Davina said, of how women's rights are relevant to so many things, including, like, I think, fracking and offshore accounts and things like that. You know, that was really, really interesting. I just wonder if you have any comments on what the next frontier is of where women's rights go. I know that's a really difficult question to start on the spot, but
Unless anybody else is burning, we'll take these two very quickly and then that will be it and sort of a response, Aruna. Yeah, Jane.
Hi, Jane Gordon, Legal Director of Sisters for Change. Really lovely to see you. I just wondered if you might expand a little bit on the comments around the UN resource constraints. For those who don't know, 6 of the 10 treaty bodies have been told that their sessions in the autumn will be cancelled this year at a time when it does feel like we are suffering some of the biggest backlash and